Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick, the podcast where each week I sit down with a different guest as we discuss their career, along with the story of the worst gift they've ever been given. Joining me this week is Daniel James. A member of pop duo Yell, an early act signed by none other than Simon Cowell, to walking the cobbles of Coronation Street and the streets of Albert Square as an actor in EastEnders, Daniel's done it all. He stops by to discuss his incredible career and, of course, the worst gift he's ever been given. So, Daniel, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for asking me.
No problem at all. I'm really looking forward to finding out all about you and your career. And I wanted to go right back to the beginning. Was performing and singing and, you know, being on TV and in films, was that an interest from an early age?
There's nobody in my family that is the slightest bit into show business. I originally come from the northeast of, well, actually born in Bletchley in Buckinghamshire. But I was very young and we moved back up to the northeast because that's where my mum and dad are from. And there isn't anybody. My mum can sing, but I wasn't in one of those houses where there would be like, you know, ballads and music. Or there was no music played in my house whatsoever. In fact, when I started singing, I think I was in a local paper and my mum was at work and all the women sort of went to her in work and said, oh, your boy, we saw him in the paper, you know, and they were asking, she said, I haven't got a clue. I've never heard him sing around the house. So I was like a man of mystery. I did sing. I was Joseph in the primary school nativity. And that was my first experience of an audience. And we'd done all the rehearsals and I had no idea what it would feel like, but I remember my mum was in about the third or fourth row. The school hall was chocker. And my dad, I suddenly heard the swing doors at the back of the hall. And my dad came in and stood at the back. All the curtains were closed because it was like a winter's night. And at the end of the nativity, I had a big song with a big note at the end. So I sang the song, and then as I hit the big note, all went well, and there was like a silence for a couple of seconds, and I kind of thought, oh, but then they all clapped, and that kind of feeling, it was just a great feeling, and I thought, I quite like this.
Yeah.
I'd never had any idea about the stage or anything before. And then when I went to senior school, I started a band with a bit of a cringy name, Hot Ice.
Nice. It's original.
And we used to, one of my mates at school lived directly opposite the school. So we'd go to his house after school and we'd practice in his garage. But unfortunately for me, in my senior school, the rugby teacher was a bit of a brute. Have you seen the movie Kez?
Yes.
That was my school. And basically, my PE teacher, Mr. Grattan, was obsessed with rugby, but he was also the drama teacher. And he said to me one day, he must have asked around the class, and I must have said, yeah, you know, I'm interested in doing a bit of drama, doing a bit of singing and stuff. And he said to me, you can only do the drama if you play on the rugby team. He said, you're a big lad. He said, I want to see you out there 3 times a week training and every weekend. And I thought, you're joking. I hate rugby. I mean, I don't hate it, but when I was a kid, I didn't like it, you know? And also from the northeast, the soil in the winter, it wasn't just hard. You could grate cheese on it, right? I know one guy fell over and in a rugby tackle at school and his head hit the floor and one of his teeth was still left in the soil. So you can kind of understand my slight reticence at not jumping at Mr. Grattan's suggestion that I get out there 3 times a week and do me training. So I said no, and he said, well, if you're not going to play a ball with me, Sonny, you're not going to be in the drama group, right? So for the whole 4 years at senior school, I never got to sing a note, never got to acting anything, watched everyone else having a good time. So, and then my geography teacher, Mr. Dawson, at the end of one lesson, he said to everybody, what do you want to do when you leave school? And everybody answered, and I said what I wanted to do, because by then I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to sing and act. And he looked at me like I had 2 heads. And he said, stay behind after school. Stay behind. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm for the high jump.
He thought you were joking.
He said to me, come here. He said, what did you say to me in that class? And I said, well, I wanted to act. And he went, act? He said, were you born in a trunk? And I said, no. But it was a bit like Billy Elliot, you know. Yes. I mean, I wasn't ballet dancing around, but that was the attitude. And he said, no, you weren't born in a trunk, boy, so don't be so bloody stupid. Clipped me round the ear and said, you'll never go on the stage, mm-hmm. you'll get out. And that was it. So I had the drama. I had the rugby teacher, stroke drama teacher, who wouldn't let me do any singing and acting because I wouldn't play rugby. And then the geography teacher. So my whole senior sort of life was a little bit unfortunate when it came to being creative. So then I moved to London. And once I got to London, I just went crazy. I just knocked on every door going because it was like making, oh, and in the middle of all of that, I auditioned for the National Youth Theatre. In Newcastle, some actor came up from London and it went well and I got in. So I'm in the car with my mum and dad one Sunday afternoon and I've got in, I've been accepted and I'm chuffed. And I told my mum, and my mum was all right about it, but she said, you'll have to tell your dad. And I said, well, can't you tell me, dad? And she said, no, you tell your dad. So I'm in the car waiting for that moment when I can tell him. And I told him and he went, drama, London? Are you joking? He said, you're not going to London on your own, you're 14. So that was the three things in my life as a young kid where everything was just closed off.
So your early career was very much focused in television. What are your early memories from that time? And was music still very much on the agenda?
I moved to London when I was 17. I'd started my equity card and I just went to loads of auditions for TV, for dramas. And then one of the auditions came along. And it was to be a cheerleader on Top of the Pops. Years ago, Top of the Pops used to be the show. Yeah. I mean, it was just the business. And they wanted to liven it up a bit because it was all kind of old guys, record pluggers, and the audience kind of were just sitting still all the time watching the bands. So they got about a dozen of us, you know, young'uns in. And after 3 weeks, they asked if I'd like to do the warm-up. So I used to do the warm-up for Top of the Pops, and it was brilliant. You know, you'd see all these big acts flying from the States, and everybody you'd seen on the telly was there. So that was a fabulous experience. And my girlfriend at the time, Michelle, I'd always put her name on the door at 6. So she'd turn up from work at 6 o'clock and her eyes would be agog. She, you know, who we had on that night. You know, 6 months or, well, maybe a little bit earlier than that, we were both at home watching Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
So there we were. She was in the audience and I was jigging about behind the stage, you know, behind the acts. So it was like a dream come true. And I was up in the bar, the BBC bar one night, and in the BBC bar, on one side, you had all the drama people. And on the left side, you had all the Top of the Pops people who just come off stage. So it was incredible. And one night, this guy tapped me on the shoulder and he said, you do a good job of that warm-up. He said, do you do anything else? And I said, well, I sing and act. And he went, right. He said, I've got a record company. He said, we're number two at the moment. And he had a big hit. And he said, I've got some money to spend. Would you like to come to the studio? So a week later, I cycled all the way from Chiswick to Golders Green. Met this guy called Ray and we had a chat and he persuaded me to do a cover version of the old Bobby Darin hit Dream Lover. But we did a real modern version. It was really, really good. It wasn't like twanging 50s. And I went off to do pantomime in Glasgow. So I was up in Glasgow and I got a phone call one Saturday morning at my digs and he said, there are some noises on the track. You're going to have to come back. So I had to get the overnight train back in the middle of rehearsal. I had to ask the director if I could. This was really funny because I said to the director back in the afternoon at rehearsals this Saturday, I said, I'm really sorry, but, and he went, you want to leave? And I went, no, can I leave half an hour early on Saturday so I can get the train? I don't know what impression I must have been giving, you know, in those rehearsals. Anyway, so basically I was a merry man, so I can't have been that merry. I must have been the most unmerry man going. I bombed down to London, got there the next morning, absolutely knackered, re-recorded it. It never sounded as good. That first version was fabulous. The second version, my vocal sounded tired. And when the record was pressed, I was a little bit disappointed with it, but I was even more disappointed. Every week while I was up in pantomime, I'd go into like local record shops and be checking the chart and going through the records, knowing that my record was coming out. They pressed a white heart-shaped version and it was going to come out on Valentine's Day.
Oh, nice.
So I was so excited. Anyway, I went into this record shop and they had the radio on in the record shop while I was in there. And this DJ said, and now the new release from Dana, Dream Lover. So Dana had recorded and it came out 2 weeks before mine.
No.
So that put the kibosh on my first single. My first single came out But it obviously didn't get anywhere because Dana had, you know, plummeted the lower end of the chart before me. So that was my first experience, but I'd learned so much in the studio. It was a fabulous experience. So I came back from pantomime and I started to work back on Top of the Pops again. And then the guy who was directing Top of the Pops was also directing Cracker Jack. So he said, would you come and do the warm-up for Cracker Jack, which was great fun. It was at the TV theater where all the big stars of the 60s and 70s and 80s had done their TV shows, like Cilla Black, Cliff Richard. It was like just amazing place where Wogan did his chat show years later. And I met two guys, one called Matt and another called Mike, Matt Aitken and Mike Stock, later to be Stock Aitken Waterman.
Yes.
And basically we decided to make a record. So I went down to Mike's house in Abbeywood, Southeast London. And after a couple of weeks, we recorded a track called Safety in Numbers. And then I went back and we recorded another one called When Love Slips Through My Finger. And I mean, they were nice tracks. We, you know, we got on really well. They were two sharp guys. They were young, they were hungry, they were edgy, and you could see that they were destined for really good things. So I went, when the record was all pressed, I proudly kind of walked into the Cracker Jack office and Paul Ciani was sitting there, the producer and director, gave him the record and he went, oh, right, okay. He said, look, I'll let you know what I think. So the next week I went back in the office and he said, I love the B-side. He said, I can't stand the A-side.
Oh, interesting.
He said, if you get your record company to put the B-side on the A-side, you can have a spot on the show, legitimate. Wow. As an act, not just doing the warm-up, you know? We can imagine. I was so excited. So the next day, I was on the phone to the record company, but by then they pressed thousands of the tracks and the labels, and they'd had the photos done. They wouldn't flip it. So I had to go back and tell Paul, and he thought we were mad. Well, I wasn't, because I wanted to flip it, you know? So we lost the slot on Cracker Jack, and that second single went down the pan.
Now, in 1986, you competed to represent the UK in the Eurovision Song Contest. And I was interested to hear how that all came to be.
I was doing little acting jobs. I was writing songs, and I met a guy called Tony Hiller. And anybody that's into Eurovision will know that Tony Hiller was Eurovision royalty. He wrote lots of songs. One notable song was Save Your Kisses for Me, Brotherhood of Man.
Yes.
One of the biggest ever Eurovision winners. Even had a hit in America with that one, which is quite rare for Eurovision songs. I think maybe Gina G and a couple of others have managed to crack the American charts with their Eurovision song. So I met up with Tony, and he was working with two guys called Bradley and Stuart James. And Bradley and Stuart had just co-written a song called Every Loser Wins, which was a number one hit for Nick Berry. They kind of brought their skills with Tony Hiller, and they wrote this fabulous power ballad called No Easy Way to Love. Great track, great ballad. So we rehearsed it, we recorded it, and the day I was recording it, I met Tony, and he said, all the acts for good luck, they meet me early before the recording studio, and I take them to this fabulous restaurant just off Edgware Road, and we have liver and onions. Can you imagine? Can you imagine Simon Cowell saying to One Direction, just before you do your new single, I'm taking you for liver and onions, boys. You know, can you imagine Justin Bieber, liver and onions? I don't think so. So anyway, I'm sitting in the restaurant, and the thing was, he had been around for decades. So he told me stories about Tin Pan Alley. You know, he told me stories about Eurovision. It was an education. And then we went in and recorded the track. Luckily, I didn't chuck the liver and onions over the mic, and it went really well. And a few weeks later, we were doing some photos, and they decided they wanted me to be blonde. Now, you can see I'm the least blonde person going.
I can see.
So they sent me to this really swanky hairdresser's in Knightsbridge where George Michael's sister worked. So Melanie, who sadly since passed away, rest her soul, she coloured my hair very, very blonde.
Oh, wow.
And I'm quite pale. So you can imagine me blonde and pale, you know. They say pale and interesting. I think I was pale and anemic. So anyway, the following week, we're at TV Centre, and there's a horseshoe at TV Centre. And all of us were there. We were standing around Terry Wogan. They took the pictures, like promo pictures for the Radio Times. But I realised when I looked at some of the Polaroids that I was okay as a blonde, but it really, and also there were some other people in the show that were blonde. So the following week, I trotted back to the hairdressers, and I was then returned to my crowning brunette glory. My mum was relieved.
Yes.
So the following week, so then we had to change the jacket because the jacket didn't go with the hair. So the following week I was on Wogan.
Oh, wow.
So I'm standing on Wogan. I took my brother with me and the audience is all there. And of course I'd done the warm-ups for Crackerjack there. So it was like going home. It's brilliant. So I'm standing there feeling really comfortable, getting ready to sing my first line. And I suddenly felt this enormous burp coming on. Oh, no. And I just, you know, I thought, what am I going to do? I could. Terry introduced me. My brother's at the side of the stage, and I'm looking at my brother, and he can see me sort of going, and I've got my head slightly down because the cameras, there's like three cameras or four cameras, and there's one above my head, and they're all coming towards me like Daleks. And I can hear Terry saying, and blah, 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 with No Easy Way to Love, song four. And the audience are clapping. And I thought, what am I going to do? So while the clapping was on and the piano, I kind of ducked my head. I got the mic and took it right round to my back and I let out this ripper of a burp. What was I to do? But I could see my brother looking at me because he was panicking, thinking I was just going to burp on camera on live TV, which nearly happened, you know? So I managed to just lift my head up as the burp was ending, bring the mic up and then sort of like, smoothly do these very lovely lyrics into the camera. But you know, if anybody had known sitting at home that I just let this ripper out, and I remember when it was finished and I walked off, I saw the sound man and the guy on the boom, and they both looked at me and kind of like put their hands out because they were like, how did you pull that off? Yeah. And after that, I did children's BBC. I got a job doing the birthdays. And then I was asked from the birthdays to do a series called But First This. And it was with Andy Crane and Sue Devaney. Sue Devaney plays Kevin Webster's sister in Corrie. And it was kind of like pop music, interviews, cartoons, TV programs. It was 3 hours live every morning, Monday to Friday. And it was a great experience. I got to meet loads of bands. I got to present and I got to learn how to wear an earpiece. Every presenter at the BBC has their own earpiece. Oh. And they sent me to this really snazzy place, just, I think it was Great Portland Street or Harley Street. And they mould
So it's like custom fitted.
Custom fitted, yeah, because you know, you just plug it in. Because obviously you can imagine if you were wearing someone else's, you can imagine they walk away and you put it on and there's a big lump of wax on it, you know? I mean, no names mentioned, you know, but I'm sure there's a few waxy ears at the BBC.
So how did Yell come to be formed?
On the very last week, one of the guys that had been coming around plugging groups was called Jeff Chegwin. In those days, pluggers would come and they would play music to the producer and say, would you have them on as a guest? And you'd get to meet the pluggers. And Jeff said to me in my last week, what are you going to do next? It's the worst question you can ever ask a performer. You know, especially actors, what are you going to do next? Because most actors haven't got a clue what they're going to do next, you know? So I said to him, well, I sing. I've got some songs I want to finish off and see what happens. Then he went, oh, right. He said, you know what? He said, my office is in Gnomis. And Gnomis was a legendary rehearsal studio between Shepherd's Bush and Olympia. And all the big acts rehearsed there. It was fantastic. So he asked me to go down and play him some songs the following week. So I popped down there the following week, played him some songs. And he said, I want to introduce you to somebody. And the following week, I went back and he introduced me to Paul. And we went off downstairs and had a cup of tea. And we got on and we decided to write some songs together. And for the next 18 months, we wrote songs. And we then, well, before the 18 months were up, after a couple of months, we decided to form the group. I came up with the name Yell. And we started to gig. And we were driving this battered old car all over the country on a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night. Birmingham, we'd do a club in Birmingham at 11 o'clock. And then we'd get to another one. We'd screech across town to another one at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know?
Oh, wow.
But we were learning our trade as a duo. You know, learning, you know, all the skills you need to learn and also gelling as an act and finding out our pluses, our minuses, our strengths. And that was going on. And while that was going on, Jeff then introduced us to a woman that ran a lunch club in schools. So we would write songs during the day, some days, And then other days we would turn up at schools all over the country and kids would be having their lunch and then the curtains would go back in the school hall and Paul and I, we'd suddenly turn up and the music had come on. We'd do the songs.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Duck and Bowls of Semolina and Sponge Pudding, you know, he's flinging around. But it was great fun. And we built up like a younger audience by day. And then Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, we built up an older audience at night.
Ah,
and we
were playing
a mixture of songs, our own songs and different songs. So after about 18 months, we were quite polished by then. And Jeff said, it's time to do a showcase. I think nowadays they just pick acts off YouTube. But we did a showcase for loads of record companies. And there were two that were really interested. One was CBS and one was Fanfare. No criticism of Fanfare, but I wanted to sign with CBS.
Yeah.
I saw myself as a singer-songwriter. We'd written three great ballads on the album that were about relationships I'd had, and we'd written some up-tempo stuff, and I'd always written songs, and I wanted to be with a label that could maybe push us in the States. Unfortunately, I was outvoted, and we ended up with Fanfare.
Dan, we reached the part of the show where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
Right. Well, it's a toss-up, really, between the worst Christmas jumper you've ever had in your life that an aunt knitted for me.
Oh.
And on the front of the jumper, you're not going to believe, it was a Christmas jumper. It didn't have a Santa on it. It didn't have a robin on it. It had a fish on it.
A fish?
Who would knit a jumper with a cod on it? A cod jumper. So that was my worst Christmas gift. And because it was knitted by a relative, I had to wear it often.
Of course.
Not only had she knitted a big fish on the front, but the bit where the eye was, it got caught on something and it had pulled. So the eye bit was hanging out and one sleeve was a bit longer than the other. So that was the worst Christmas gift. But it, running a close second was my Nana, who every year, for some bizarre reason, would buy me a packet of fresh dates.
Okay.
I don't know whether you've ever eaten fresh dates with stones in them.
Oh.
Yeah, they're not a barrel of laughs, believe me. You kind of chew for a good quarter of an hour. And when your nana gives you them and asks you to open them in front of her and then expects to watch a movie with you on Christmas afternoon and watch you eat half a dozen of them, it's not the funnest Christmas afternoon you've ever had. So it's a toss-up between Nana's dates and Auntie's jumper.
I wanted to touch a bit on your experience with Simon, because I know that you were signed by Simon, but obviously much before his, you know, BGT and X Factor days, he was much less known back then. So I wonder what that experience was like in terms of getting signed.
Well, it was interesting because you've timed your question perfectly, because we did the showcase. Simon came along and he was very interested and he signed us after the two showcases. And we got on well. But the thing about Simon, and I'm sure he'll admit this himself, Simon loves a cover version.
Ah.
And
yes,
it's no joke that Simon used to sleep with the Guinness Book of Hit Singles under his pillow. You know, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of other things you could have under your pillow, but he had the Guinness Book of Hit Singles. And every day we go in the office and he'd be thumbing through, because obviously he had Sunita at the time.
Yes.
And she, you know, she recorded Right Back Where You Started From and some other covers. And he just loved cover versions. So we played him all our material and he kind of liked it, but he didn't fall over himself initially to be interested. And of course, although we'd signed with him, I still had these ambitions to be this singer-songwriter in this band. But Simon really wanted to go with a cover version. So we'd been touring for nearly, you know, 18 months and we were quite tired. So Paul and I went off to Ibiza to have a bit of, we had a week in Ibiza. We had a really nice break. And I think it was like on the Thursday night or something. Now, before we'd left, we obviously had a meeting with Simon and it was like a tennis match. The ball being the song title, and I'd be one side of the table and Simon with the other, and we'd be lobbing it back over at each other because I'd want to do one of our songs and he'd want to do a cover version. So it was like a tennis match going on for the whole meeting. But in the end, we kind of didn't decide on any songs, and Paul and I nipped off for a holiday.
So Yell's debut single was a cover of Dan Hartman's Instant Replay. I wondered if that was a group decision or was that cover track suggested from, say, the record company?
We were in this chill out place about 2 in the morning and they were playing really laid back music, and then they changed the DJ. And the DJ came on and we heard 10, 9. I won't do the whole numbers. You'd be in a coma. So basically, the original starts quite low key.
Yes.
With just some tom-toms and the numbers. But as soon as the music came in, the floor was rammed. People went bananas for this track. And I looked at Paul and I said, I think this could be the one. Simon's looking for a cover. Why don't we go back with a cover? Why don't we pick the cover? So 4 or 5 days later, you know, all resplendent in our suntans, feeling cool and probably looking ridiculous, we turned up at the meeting. And of course, Simon's more brown than us. You know, Simon's more tanned than all of us. You know, we'd had a week in Ibiza. We turned up and he's chocolate brown and I'm still pale. You know, he got the tone. You know, I think he was the original David Dickinson, bless him. So he's sitting there all resplendent, looking amazing. And Paul and I are now looking pale. And I mentioned the song. And he looked at me with a very strange look on his face. And I said, hang on a minute, Simon, you've been going on about a cover version for ages. I've come up with a cover version. What's the matter? And he picked up the Guinness Book of Hit Singles and he thumbed it. And it, as it fell open, he turned the page over the night before on instant replay.
No.
Mystic Meg Lives.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was fate.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know whether it was fate that we signed with Fan Fare. Maybe it was. As I say, I wanted to be the singer-songwriter with a band. We ended up with Fan Fare. It was an amazing experience. But we ended up doing instant replay. And Simon said, who are we going to get to produce it? Jeff Chegwin, our manager, knew of a guy, Nigel Wright, who was in a big 80s jazz funk band called Shack Attack. And they'd been on Top of the Pops when I'd been a cheerleader, so I remembered him. But Jeff rang Nigel Wright up. And 2 days later, we're at the meeting with Simon in Fan Fare, and this amazing Cadillac, American vintage car, pulls into the driveway. And you can imagine you've got Simon with the biggest sports car in the world and the, you know, the coolest, you know, thinks he's Simon Templar from The Saint, bless him. And then you've got Nigel turning up in the Cadillac, you know, and I'm standing there with my pedal bike. So they come in, and anyway, in, to cut long story short, it's decided that Nigel would produce us. So a week later, we're in his studio and we recorded the track. And in the afternoon, the sports car turned up and Simon turned up, which is great because that's what you want from an A&R guy when you're head of record company. You want someone that's hands-on and involved. However, he came in and we played him. Nigel had done a great backing track. He's a great arranger, a great producer. He went on to work do stuff with Barbra Streisand. He was, you know, amazing, amazing. Andrew Lloyd Webber, everybody. So we played him the track. We had the guy vocal on the track and it sounded amazing. And we're sitting there all chuffed. And Simon said, boys, I want you to go back in the booth and I want you to sing it falsetto. Falsetto? You can imagine there's a word that I was saying in the middle of the falsetto. Falsetto, you've got to be joking. So we had a sort of gentleman's agreement where obviously there was another tennis match going backwards and forwards because, you know, yeah, I can sing falsetto, but we've already got the Bee Gees and I don't want to spend, you know, I'm thinking maybe 5 years. I don't want to spend the next 5 years of my life, you know, singing, you set my lips on fire. You know, I'm not Leo Sayer,
yes.
You know. Not wanting to sing, but I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of this? Because obviously Simon's a strong character. We've just signed. He's put a load of money into us. And what Simon wants, Simon gets. Mm. And I'm looking at Paul and I'm thinking, what are we going to do? So we went back in the booth. And before Nigel put the track back on and before the mics were turned on, I said to Paul, the only way we're going to get out of this is if we do the worst falsetto ever. So we kind of looked at each other, but I said, what we've got to do is make it look to him like we're taking it really seriously. So don't let him see that we're cocking it up, you know? Mm. So the track came on and we're sort of, you know, we've got one hand on the cams, you know, the cliche look, you know, and we're doing it all professional. And then, the intro comes on and I've got the first line, you know? And I sort of go, and then Paul came in with, well, you can imagine dogs in streets nearby were howling, you know. So we got three, but the worst thing was he let us carry on. He let us carry on. We got halfway through the second verse. By then, I had sawdust in my throat. you know. I won't tell you where my testicles were. So basically, there was a knock on the desk, a tap on the mixing desk, and he gestured with his fingers. It was a polite gesture, don't worry. And he said, come in, boys. So we went back in and he said, thankfully, we played it. I mean, we played it straight. Even though we had done the most diabolical vocal ever, we kept straight faces and looked like we really meant it. So we got back into the boot, into the studio, and he said, yeah, boys, he said, I don't think the falsetto is going to work. he said, let's do it your way. You know, I had to stifle the biggest laugh ever. And like Paul and I couldn't look at each other. I think Nigel kind of got wind of it. You know, he's looking out the corner of his eye. But very rarely do you get Simon Cowell to back down. But he magnanimously conceded and said, let's do it your way, boys.
So you've been signed, you released that debut single. Talk to me a bit, Daniel, about that early success, because I'm guessing you're both suddenly just flung into this whole new world.
It was all systems go. You know, we were off doing photo sessions. We did like 30 magazine covers in a month. We were on every television show going, morning, noon and night, flying here, there and everywhere. We were still managing to write the odd song, sitting in a car, the back of the car. And then it came out and it just zoomed up the charts and it was just the most amazing. I wouldn't swap it for the world. Even though, you know, things didn't turn out in the long run as I'd like them to have done, that particular experience, we were touring all over the world and it was just every guy, every person's dream. You know, a lot of people when we were younger, you know, some people wanted to be a footballer or a scientist or a sportsman. But a lot of people wanted to be on Top of the Pops and would stand in front of the mirror pretending it was them. Well, I got to do it for real. I got to go back to Top of the Pops where I'd been a cheerleader and actually perform on there. Can you imagine?
Proper full circle moment.
It was amazing. We were on the Top of the Pops a couple of times and the guy that directed me in Crackerjack and wanted to put me on with When Love Slips Through the Finger, he was directing Top of the Pops.
Oh, no way.
So from the gallery, and he came over and he was so happy that we were there, you know. He was so pleased for me that it'd come full circle. So that was the most amazing experience. And that was my experience with Yell.
Now, of course, like the Yell experience did come to an end, but was it something that you foresaw coming? Or was it a bit of a shock?
Unfortunately, no. I'd written some songs about me, and Paul and I had written some songs together, and we were finishing off the album because obviously the trouble was, Simon wasn't sure about the follow-up single. I'm not, you know, slagging Simon off at all, because there were some sides to Simon that were absolutely fantastic. He only wanted the best for us. And obviously he thought his way was the best way. The problem was the record company kind of waited too long for the second single to come out. You know, I mean, I'd grown a beard as long as Father Christmas's by the time we got around to deciding it, you know. When you've got a hit single and you've got we had a youngish fan base, you've got to get the second single out really quickly to consolidate the fan base. And I think Simon wanted to wait for PWL to be ready. And they had a huge shopping list of artists. So we were way down the list. So we had to kind of wait our turn.
Yeah.
So we went off on tour to do stuff. And in the meantime, I'm saying to Simon, Simon, there's a great track on the album called I Get the Feeling. And I said, if you give it to P. Hammond, he'll do a great remix, you know? But it was like banging my head against the wall, not because he hated the track. The funniest thing is, I'll give Simon his due. There was some three ballads on the album, and one of them was called Give Me a Little More Time. We'd recorded them. We'd been over in the States and recorded with Martika's producer. We'd been in LA. It was fantastic. You know, David swimming in David Hockney's swimming pool in the lift with the guy from the Fine Young Cannibals. It was just, we went to the Grammys. You know, we were living the life. It was amazing. And I kept trying my best to get Simon to release one of our songs, an up-tempo song, but we left it too long. And by the time the second single was ready, it kind of didn't do as well as it should have done. And then we ended up recording the single with Stock Aitken and Waterman, but they were then going through a bit more of an experimental phase. So we didn't get the usual kind of Stock Aitken Waterman track. We got a very American-based kind of track. It was called One Thing Leads to Another. Nothing wrong with the track, but it didn't kind of follow the line of Yell. It didn't go the way we'd been going. And so unfortunately that came out and we were in a studio finishing off one of the album tracks, a ballad. And as I say, we were in the studio one day with Colin Thurston finishing off the last album track. And I came home buzzing because it sounded great. And I woke up the next morning and opened the paper. And it was in the paper, the group were finished. It was the biggest shock of my life. I had no idea.
That's awful. We'd
just that week been offered an enormous amount of money to tour Japan. We were big, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but we were doing very, very well in Japan, you know? And they wanted us to tour over there and they were offered us lots of money. And then I woke up and it was just gone. It just took me by surprise and I was devastated. I had a bit of a breakdown. It was the worst experience of my life. I know we've got to be realistic. Lots of people lose their jobs. It's not, you know, not just people in the music business or the arts. You know, I'm no different to anybody else who loses a job. It's devastating. Mm. And it took me a long time to pick myself up off the floor.
After Yale, you moved to New York and performed in an off-Broadway production. How was that experience?
I thought I'd never sing again. It was just, I had a bit of a breakdown. It was a terribly negative time for me. And I went off to New York. Nobody knew me there. And I lost myself in New York. I didn't have any reference points there. There were no magazines. I wasn't on the radio. I wasn't on telly. I was a nobody.
Yeah.
Walking around something that looked like a movie set. And I ended up living there for a while. I made some friends and I ended up workshopping a play. We workshopped it for about 2 or 3 months in the summer and then put it on off-Broadway as a workshop performance. And that was wonderful because it was nothing to do with singing. I'd lost the will to sing, you know? I mean, probably some people are clapping. But, I never thought I'd sing again. It was such a sad time for me. So it was a relief to be doing something totally unrelated. And I lost myself in New York and did the play. And then I came back and started to do TV and stuff again. And I ended up getting an agent and I had guest roles in Casualty, Doctors, Coronation Street, The Last Tango in Halifax, and just carried on acting. I did sort of write notes down for songs, but I never sung. I just never thought I would ever sing again. I had a really bad opinion about myself, about my singing. I just felt very negative. And a girl that had been a friend of a fan of the group, the Yale fans were amazing. It might sound a bit of a cliche, but, you know, I went from having fans sleeping outside my door. I mean, we can imagine my mum and dad visiting me with people sleeping outside the door. My mum and dad couldn't take it in, you know, because I'm just their son. You know,
yeah.
It was the weirdest thing ever, you know.
We're going to touch on the new music very shortly, but before that, I want to know when you did make it back into the studio, what was that process like? Starting to sing again.
I truly never thought I'd sing again at the time. And a friend of one of the fans, Melissa Whitehouse, had started recording stuff. And she asked me down to the studio to meet her and she played me some of her stuff. And it was nice, but I still felt really removed, you know, really removed from it as a performer. And she said to me, how about us, you and I recording together? And I said, I've done one duo, maybe I shouldn't do another. And she said, come on, let's just have a go. So we decided to do a version of the old Minnie Riperton hit, Loving You.
Oh, yeah.
So we played around with it again. We added some words and we modernized it a little bit. And then the day came for me to go in and record it. And I got in the studio and the track came on and I didn't know what to do. And then I put one can on my ear. The first line of the song, as soon as I heard myself singing, a weight just dropped off my shoulders. It was like, why haven't I been doing this? Why did I stop? And it was just wonderful. It just all came back to me, but all the good things.
Yeah.
You know, all the wonderful things about being in the studio, about being creative, about being recording. And it just, all the tension and stress and the kind of unhappiness fell away. And it was a joy. So we recorded Loving You and then put that to one side. And then I just went back to acting. And just before lockdown, I did an episode of EastEnders playing this guy that I bought a car from Ben Mitchell, Phil Mitchell's son. And I ended up having a big ruck with him because it was a dodgy motor. And I stormed onto the lot and had a ruck with him and then reversed over his daughter. You can imagine as you do, you know. And then the week we finished recording it and there was a little part of me thought that I would be going back because obviously nobody messes with the Mitchells.
No, you know, of course.
You'd be sorted, you know. So the lockdown came and all the stories were rewritten. So I never got my comeuppance from Phil and Ben.
Let's touch on the latest single, Ben, because of course you've been back in the studio making the new music. So tell us a bit more about it.
So lockdown started and all my family live hundreds of miles away. I was on my own. And all I would do, the thing that kept me sane, because I think all of us in the first lockdown, we're always watching the 5 o'clock bulletin.
Yes.
Always looking on the internet, always looking at the news. You know, it's like, what's going to happen next? All over the world, we were all in this same situation, this pandemic. And we were full of questions, you know, and wondering what was going to happen next. So I would go out on a night in the dark, late, walking. That was my only kind of solace. It was how I kind of processed things, you know. And I knew nobody would be about because we weren't supposed to mix with anybody.
That's right.
So I went out for these really long walks in London and I went to places I'd never been before. I'd walk miles. And in my mind, I'd be thinking about not being able to see my family and how sad I felt. And then I'd be thinking about the things I'd seen during the day in the papers or on the internet about, you know, elderly people in care homes that couldn't see their children, you know, families that were missing their grandchildren, you know, businesses going bust, people losing jobs and businesses and families, as I say, separated. And all these emotions were spinning around in my head. And as the quicker I walked, these lines came into my head, you know, as the world turns its head, there are people around me with their hearts in their mouths, not knowing the right way they should turn, watching hair turning grey. Seeing children turn into adults, days running away, it's falling apart at the seams. Because that's how it felt. Mm. I mean, I hope people can relate to those lyrics of the first verse because it just felt like that, you know, because people were in homes and not seeing families, you know, people were dying and there wasn't anybody there to hold their hands. Children weren't being able to go out and play with their mates, you know? So the thing was, usually when you write a song, you've got a dictaphone or a mobile with you. Like if you wake up in the middle of the night in bed and you come up with a song, the best thing to do is get up and put the idea down because you guarantee if you roll over, you won't remember the next thing, you know? So I raced home on this walk because I didn't have my phone with me. So I ran in the door and just mumbled down the first verse and the kind of melody and then went to bed. The next day, it was running around in my head, but this time I took my phone with me. So I went out and I wrote the second verse on the second night, and I really felt quite passionately about this song. It really felt important. On the third night, I wrote the choruses, and on the fourth night, I wrote the middle eight. And then when that was finished, I got another couple of songs wrote as well. I've got a follow-up single I'm hoping to bring out in August, which is very different. I've played it to a few people and it's very upbeat and summery. It's the kind of thing you could play driving around the seafront with your car roof down. It's very upbeat. It's called Do You Remember Me?
If you could go right back to the beginning of your career and give yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
I would tell myself to stop worrying about what people think. And I would give myself a bit more confidence because you can appear confident on screen. But I think it goes back to my school days when the teachers at school, they didn't let me do any, you know, in my senior school, they kind of knocked me back a lot. Yeah. Every time I tried to do something creative, I mean, I gave you a couple of examples earlier, but there were many more where I would kind of do something and they'd absolutely hammer me. And I think I kind of ended up leaving school feeling pretty crap and not very talented creatively. So the gift I'd give myself would be the gift, two things. One, a little bit more confidence, not showy offy confidence, but just inner confidence of just do it and it'll be all right.
Yeah.
And the second one, not to worry about what people think and just get out there and throw it against the wall and see what sticks, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and also some expensive trainers because I do a lot of cardio and I teach Les Mills Body Attack. And when we were in Yale, we got sponsored by British Knights. I don't know if anyone remembers, but they were like at the time quite a big company. I've got a cupboard full still of British Knights high tops. Nice. I can't wear them. Who wears them nowadays? I've even thought about putting them on eBay, but can you imagine somebody going, aye, that guy from Yale's trying to sell his old knockoff trainers on eBay. Can you imagine? So they're in the cupboard along with the old Yale outfits. But I really like, now it costs me a bundle to get these trainers, because you need them, you know, when you're running, you need the best of the best, and you need them when you're teaching Les Mills Body Attack. So I'd buy myself some really stunning trainers.
Nice. And finally, where can people find out more about you, what you do, and of course, the music?
Well, Set Your Spirit Free is available on Spotify, Amazon, Apple iTunes, and all the sites. It is number 25 currently on the Heritage chart. It would be fabulous if people liked it, if they wouldn't mind going online to at Chart Heritage. They can vote for free, and it's currently 25. They can vote and get it up higher into the top 10, hopefully. So if you like it, please vote for Set Your Spirit Free by Daniel James on the Heritage chart.
Let's do it. Let's get it to number one.
Well, top 10 would be great.
Well, Daniel, it's been great to have you here. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.